Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 1st, 2004. Today's session number is OLP 2004-01. Today's speaker is Paul Olson. The lesson for today is Who Decides How I Think? Let's listen in.
My name is Paul Olson, and I'm serving the village this week as one of the village philosophers, for which I have zero qualifications, except that I like to engage in conversation, so we've been having a great time. As my wife and I are both doing that. Back away from Holden Village, I'm an English teacher at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, and the topic that you have on the kiosk is about what shapes our thinking. But because I'm an English teacher, I'm going to use a poem, and it maybe we'll use more than that, I've got a couple along, to illustrate the power of outside forces to shape how we think and how we perceive things. Before I start with my poem here that I've got enough to hand out, I'm going to tell you just a brief experience way back in high school with my favorite teacher. He was also our basketball coach, and he was a great social studies teacher, history teacher, everybody's role model. And in a U.S. history course, he said, when he got to the Civil War, you know, slavery really wasn't so bad. I've since gone on to my degree of specialty is African American literature, and that's what my dissertation was in, and I've since changed my mind on that. Slavery was really bad. But I use that as an illustration to ask you then, where did he get that idea? Where did this white guy, who was loved and who was sensitive and compassionate and sought justice in the world, but he comes up with that statement, you know, to his teacher, to his kids, slavery really wasn't so bad. So you have to speculate. You don't know. But that's my point. What forces out there shaped his thinking, made him conclude that slavery wasn't so bad? I'm going to write them down. I'll be your recording secretary. You tell me what you think might have possibly influenced that opinion.
He was playing devil's advocate.
Well, he wasn't. That's a great option. I mean, that's right. But he wasn't. This is what he really understood it to be. This was a guy with a master's degree in history, by the way.
What year did he say this?
He said that, oh, shucks. 1988. When I was a junior in high school. Now, who believes that? 1960.
I think you heard his parents' conversation.
Okay, so parents. We don't know, but we're going to speculate this. But we for sure know that parents play a role in how we think and how we perceive the world. Good.
There couldn't have been any America.
What?
There would have been no America had they not been able to economically sustain themselves, and they needed slaves to do that.
Oh, okay, so a value system that is economic, I guess. Slavery wasn't so bad, but look what it did for America. I never thought of that. That's good.
I was thinking of the economic level at which he lived and grew up. His young years, if it was an affluent.
Well, he's a teacher, so scratch the affluence right off the bat. but you're right. I understand what you're saying, and that's good, and that's part of.
But that's part
good.
Of the economic.
Yeah, sure. I heard something over here.
Well, the history books he'd read.
So his education.
Pre-civil rights.
Mm-hmm. It's pre-civil rights. Yeah. And it's a master's degree in education. I mean, in history. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Keith.
Maybe a bad experience with someone of color?
Whatever it might be, it's for sure legitimate to put down experiences. Though, I want to put a question mark after it. I understand what you're saying. He sure didn't have any experiences with slavery, but he must have borrowed something from the legacy of slavery, some experience, perhaps. That's a good speculation, too. Anything else?
Maybe he'd seen some crazy movie where it made it look like life was easier for, you know... but you think an educated person would not, that wouldn't really affect, but who knows?
Maybe he had spent some time in the South where there was grinding poverty at that time, and he felt that perhaps they had been better cared for when they were slaves than whatever he saw as sharecroppers or whatever they were experiencing currently.
A patriarchal image of, we have to take care of these poor folks, and then the slave owners did, and he had that.
He was trying to get away from his guilt.
Whoa.
Maybe a teacher of his.
Sure. So not only his education, we'll put books and teachers. I mean, he told me that, and I went on to major in history and English, and I didn't believe that very long, but I read different stuff. I think it was 1929. You should all write this down. I am doing a quiz at the end. I think it was 1929, a guy named Ulrich Phillips wrote a book called American Negro Slavery. Get the title now. American Negro Slavery. In some ways, for some people, it was the definitive description of slavery in America. It was 529 pages long, and it had 640 footnotes, all of which I've read, and not one of those footnotes refers to a black writer. He gathered his information from records of baptisms and births and plantation owners and how they recorded things. And the last paragraph of that book, American Negro Slavery, I don't know the historical influence of that, but I'm going to guess and speculate that it's for sure this profound book, American Negro Slavery, with that kind of title, and a guy that's got an education or got a master's degree in history, perhaps, or guessing, read that book, and at the end of that book it says this: you could travel from the North Shenandoah to the South, and travel even farther into the Deep South before you could come upon a slave that wasn't content.
Oh. Was it what?
Content. Now we'll go back to the footnotes. Not one footnote from a black writer. There's a slave narrative, there are lots of slave narratives, but one of them by James Craft, written with his wife James and Ellen Craft. It's a great story if you want to read it. It's in Arne Bontemps' collection of slave narratives. And it's the story of their escape. Well, in one of those narratives, the one by James Craft, he says, "'Tis not he," this is 19th century women, "'tis not he who looked on who can describe slavery, but he who endured." So the perspective that my really wonderful role model teacher had comes from a whole lot of people that didn't endure, but who looked on. And one of the things we all do in education, you know, you can write the word on the board, is what it's about. You know, what's the truth? And how do we seek that? In literature classes, we go after it all the time. And somehow that's what art is about. Is it? I have a phrase about art. Art always points toward truth with about five fingers. You know, it never says, that's the truth. It says, that's, you know, and it looks out to some of the things we discussed just last hour about there aren't very many absolutes out there, but in the process of trying to discover what is true, maybe that's one of the realizations we have, that there aren't any absolutes. I just now get reminded of one of my favorite stories about education. This is a true story. At Augustana, I had a student in an upper division English class who had to pass the course to stay in school. And he told me that before the course started. And I've always kind of viewed myself as not a student adversary, but as a student. I'm really for them. So I am a student adversary. I mean, not a what's the word?
Advocate.
Thank you. I'm a student advocate, not a student adversary. And I said, I'm going to help you out, and I'll give you a test ahead of time, and so on. So I gave him the test, the first one ahead of time, the night before, and it was three questions. Tom, how many days in the week begin with T? That was the first question. Next one is, how many seconds in a year? And the third question is, how many D's in Dixie? You got them all, right? I mean, this kid's going to get an A. He's going to go home and study that test. And he came back the next day. Tom, are you ready to go? I think I'm ready to go. Okay, how many days in a week begin with T? He said, four. What do you say?
Two.
Sure. Four. Jeez, I'm trying to help him, and he's so stupid. Four. I said, where do you get four? Tuesday, Thursday, today, and tomorrow. Okay, I think I'm going to give that credit. How many seconds in a year? You do the math, 12, 60, and keep multiplying it out. And he said, 12 seconds in a year. I'm like, how do you get 12? January 2nd, February 2nd, March 2nd. OK. Okay, I'm going to give credit for that. And you already see what's happening, don't you? That we are programmed to expect a certain, a whole way to look at, and here comes this kid with a different way to look at this, and now you realize this isn't a true story. But the last one is, how many D's in Dixie? So I couldn't get that one. Dixie, how many D's in Dixie? I know, I stayed up all night, and I got somewhere between 55 and 60. How do you do that? Well, we go from American Negro slavery and all the defined pictures that come out of that book, and then we listen to the slave say, "'Tis not he who looked on, but he who endured." And then we hear that crazy little story about perspective. And we start to see that all of these things, and now it was our education, wasn't it? We know there are two, and everybody thought of that right away. There are 2 days to begin with T, and there are no questions about it until somebody brings a whole new, let's call it a whole new paradigm of how to look at, in that silly example, just what a week is, what a week looks like. And a whole new paradigm of how to do math in that case, or at least think about seconds and what it means. The paradigms are out there, and they shape us. And now I'm going to slip in a recommendation on Amy Goodman's book, if you haven't read it. I just finished it. It's called The Exception to the Rulers. And I know my wife would be the first to jump on this with me and say, Paul, you use hyperbole whenever you get excited about a book. I mean, every novel I've read is the greatest novel in the history of America, if I liked it. But this might be the most important book of the last 30 years. About the influence of the media and they're going to bed with the corporations and the government. And it's Democrats and Republicans alike, and I encourage you to sort it out as you head down toward the November days.
The title?
Amy Goodman's The Exception to the Rulers. Well, and it's about perspective and how we get it, and her book is all about, and I've got it up here in a different word. Yeah, no, I have it here, the media. And one of the things that we could talk about all afternoon if we wanted to is the presentation, especially in the 50s, 60s, I'm not talking about radio and TV, of the images of black people in American culture. Lots of us are old enough, well, maybe not very many of you, are old enough to remember Beulah on the radio, and she was the servant in the house. Then you go on and think of the television programs and how blacks have been portrayed. All the way up into the 80s, into the Huxtables, you know, there are all kinds of images out there that shape our perceptions, and we have to wonder, you know, is that true? Well, let's look at this poem, and my idea how to do this would be, I'm going to hand it out, is to have you read one or two lines, and we'll just go right through them, line by line, and then when we're all done, I'll read the whole thing, and we'll get a sense of this. I picked it because it's such a familiar poem. It's Robert Frost's Mending Wall, and I suspect that lots of you have read it. I'm just going to do that and do this. There's some other poems here with it on some of these. You might have to go. I didn't know this. Might have to go every other person. I don't know. But we got it. See you. Punctuation stops, we'll stop. Not necessarily the end of the line, but for example, something there is that doesn't love a wall, we'll stop there because there's a comma, okay? And if there isn't a punctuation at the next line, there isn't, at the end of the next line, we'll go on until there's punctuation. So anybody, just read it, we don't have to raise your hand, and then offer comments right away, and we'll do it quite fast, because actually I really do want to make 6 o'clock supper. Okay, go ahead, anybody.
Comments after the lines or after the whole poem?
After the lines.
Okay.
Thank you for clarifying.
Punctuation. Something there is that doesn't love a wall.
Stop. Any comments? Now, you don't have to look for anything hidden. And that's the worst thing you can do when reading poetry is to, you know, what's this mean? What symbol is there? Just literally, what's going on? By the way, that's probably not a bad way to look at the Bible, especially at first. And then you go into what it starts out.
Well, it's referring to inanimate objects, for one thing.
Okay. We got this wall, and what?
The subject is unclear because it's not a person.
Yeah, choose your own subject.
Yeah, we don't know what it is. Something doesn't love a wall. And now this guy's gonna. Okay, go ahead.
That sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun.
What knocks it down?
Frosty.
Yeah, frosty. So one of the somethings is, actually, quotes on it, is the frost heave. And we have this image, and I'll, because I'm a wonderful artist, you should watch now. We're building up this wall, and here are the rocks that go on it, and when the frost heaves them up, some of these big rocks tumble. You've seen probably in England or New England too, those kind of walls. Okay, so one of the things that maybe this something is, the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun, okay?
And makes gaps even two can pass abreast.
Point. Literally.
Really splits the wall.
It really splits the wall. I mean, this is something like, you know, I want to just get a little bit of this wall down. I'm pushing this sucker over. And, you know, two people can walk abreast in these walls, or in these, here we are. A lot of those, and the rocks come tumbling down over here. Okay?
The work of hunters is another thing.
We'll keep going. And you go ahead.
I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone.
And keep going.
But they would have the rabbit out of hiding.
To please the yelping dogs. Thank you. Okay. And then there I'm like violating my own rule. What happens there? Get the image.
The hunters knock down the walls so that they can get the rabbits.
Yep. There's a rabbit must be hidden in among those rocks, and the dogs are there going nuts. Bark, bark, bark. And so I'm going to push these rocks up to get the rabbit out so the dogs can have something to chase. And that's, so we've got something is the frost heave, now we've got hunters. And we'll keep going. And just stop whenever you feel like it. I guess I was wrong in my little assignment. Anybody? The gaps I mean, there we are.
No one has seen them made or heard them made. But at spring mending time, we find them there.
Okay. And what do you hear there?
Bishop Berkeley.
Huh?
If the tree falls in the forest and nobody's there, can you hear it?
Yeah. So
additional force, but unknown.
Bishop Berkeley, he's there.
Jesus.
The guy who wrote that.
I've written, you can't read my writing, free, something,
a mythology.
Force, something mysterious. Okay, then we go.
I let my neighbor know beyond the hill.
We skipped a line. And it's okay, but we want to have that line in there.
Then you may have it spring.
But that's spring.
Oh, I'm sorry, you didn't skip a line. Dorothy, you get an automatic A in this course just because the teacher was... Okay.
I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again.
I'm going
to
act like an English teacher just for a second and point out, poetry is wonderful stuff, and it's... But in this one particular, these lines in particular, the rhythm of the lines matters, and you read them beautifully. And just listen to this. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. What do you get out of that?
There's a wall between
them. Right, for sure. There's a wall. So now we've got this neighbor over here setting one up, and we've got the one over here. We've got these two guys walking. Good. What else?
It's like a walk.
It's a rhythm. It's automatic. This is what we do. I'm not sure why, but we're going to do this. And okay, keep going. Good.
To each the boulders that have fallen, to each.
What does that mean?
Each one sets the boulder up from his side.
So I got some over here, and I'm going to pick these up, and my neighbor's going to pick these up, and each, we're not going to cross that line at all. Good. Okay?
And some are loaves, and some so nearly balls, We have to use a spell to make them balance.
Wow. What do you do with that?
They're hard to stack up.
This is no easy job. I mean, they're putting these up there, and they want to tumble down. It's, maybe it's one of those things. But, and then the very next, okay, and that's really important. I'm going to just write that over here. Something doesn't go on the wall. This is hard to keep it, and I'm going to undermine that, to keep it up, or to keep it together. And the next wonderful line.
Stay where you are until our backs are turned.
You ever, you guys who have raised kids ever say that? Stay where you are. Don't you dare turn on the TV, and I'm getting out of here. I don't want to know what they're doing. What do you do that in this poem? Stay where you are till our backs are turned. We use a spell.
I don't understand what I'm doing with these rocks, and I don't want to be here.
Yeah. Why am I doing this?
Yeah, right.
And I sure don't care if they even stay up. It's, stay where you are. Go ahead.
It's more for the companionship of his neighbor.
Could be. We'll watch that.
To actually catch the wall.
It's a nice assessment that he's doing this because he gets to talk with his neighbor, though they got this wall on either side of him, and they're not. And I'm not helping him with his heavy boulder. I'm doing my own. But that's good speculation. But for sure we know that once they're up, I don't care. We did it. And so, what's the purpose of the wall? He's going to talk about that. But right now, what do you think the purpose of the wall is? To them.
It's just always been there.
Just been there.
If it falls down, I gotta fix it.
Yep. And once I fixed it, I don't really care if it falls down again. There we are. Our backs are turned. Yeah. But we're gonna keep going. Great. I'm not gonna give a quiz at the end. You guys, automatic A's. You're great.
It's an annual ritual that has to be fulfilled.
So somehow this, to build this up, it's hard. But we're gonna do this ritual, and it's annual. Good. Okay. Stay where we are. Our backs are turned. And then this.
We wear our fingers rough with handling them.
Yep, great line.
It's hard again.
It's hard. I'm gonna get blisters. Not only my gloves on. I just dug rock for a week here during work camp.
But that's really what's expected.
Yeah, sure. I wear gloves every day, and I wore one pair out. I mean, a pair of gloves out, picked through, grabbing rock. And it was hard. And you know, you don't do that for a lark, do you? We wear our gloves out, we wear our fingers out. Okay, you're rolling, class.
Oh, just another kind of outdoor game.
Yeah. Purpose? We got words like
ritual.
Ritual.
Game.
Now we've got a word like game.
Game.
But it's hard, and we're gonna do this no matter what.
Well, if he does it, I'm gonna do it too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, let's remember that, everybody. If he does it, I'm going to do it too. And that's a wonderful insight, and there's a great ironic twist to it in the poem. Good. Go to another kind of game. One on the side, it comes to a little more. And then, go ahead.
There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I have an orchard. Mm-hmm.
Keep going.
My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors.
So why do farmers, you know, they're all spread out into the West. Why do they, what's the big fight between the ranchers and the farmers?
Fences.
And why do the farmers want fences?
To protect their crops.
Keep the cattle.
To keep the animals to keep those wide range of cattle from stomping over all their cornfields, whatever, yeah.
And to delineate their possession.
Yeah, that's a nice phrase too, delineate their possession. He's all pine and I'm apple orchard. Now we got an absurd scenario here. My apple trees aren't going to eat his pine cones. So we don't really need this wall and this ritual game, and it's not necessary. But, and then we have the, huh?
But the saying is, he says.
But the saying is, good fences make good neighbors. So what word do we put down for that? We got ritual already.
Boundaries.
Okay, we got boundaries.
Territorial instincts. Kind of tradition.
Oh, listen to that instinct.
Tradition.
Territorial instincts of men defending their boundaries.
Old adages.
Adages.
Well, and the historical note to this, too, is these guys didn't build this fence. These fences date back to the early 19th century. And so they're just continuing something that has nothing to do with their present situation.
Yep. I'm going to put down historical preservation.
How about compulsion?
And I'll put down compulsion. If anybody gives me a word I can't spell, you have to leave. And you might have got close there.
Okay.
I'm also kind of afraid of getting to know you.
So we're going to build this wall to keep us separate.
Okay. The idea of the fence is bigger than them. I mean, it dictates their actions. They're just pawns, really.
Oh, that's interesting.
The idea, I'm going to write it this way, because you said the idea of fence is bigger than purpose or need or anything. It's this idea of the fence.
Yeah, good.
Are you already getting some ideas about institutional or other non-institutionalized forces that shape what's making this guy do this? Well, you are. Keep going. And just stop wherever you think you should. I mean, I'll let you guys decide. You're great, so.
Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do you make good neighbors?
Okay, great. Question, what do you have there?
Questioning the status quo.
Yep. So now this wall, we're trying to build this, and we're going to question the status quo. Aren't you glad I write the board for you? Can you tell what the heck is going on? Even what it says. Okay.
Why does he refer to it as mischief? Oh, is he getting out of the box? David.
Well, he is getting out of the box. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
That's a great way to put it. I mean, he's not thinking inside the box. I'm just going to be a little squirrely here now. Why?
Well, but it's spring. He is getting out of the box. He's been in this cabin in the winter all winter long, and he is just, let me get out of here.
Yep. And while I'm getting out of here, I'm still going to, I'm going to be the devil's advocate here. Why do we do this? Okay, you got the question. Keep going. And then the question is, he develops that more specifically.
Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Keep going.
Well, we'll stop there since you did.
Okay. That's usually the reason.
That would be a practical reason for the fence.
Yeah.
We got cows. But now let's just watch him start to discard these practical reasons for a fence. Or that image I started with, these practical reasons. And I'll start thinking of all kinds of controversial issues out there. So go ahead.
Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in, walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense.
Okay. Anybody heard that before you heard this poem? This was a very, very famous poem in the 60s because...
Berlin Wall.
The Berlin Wall. Mm-hmm. And Robert Frost read this poem and imagine the power of that line. Before I built a wall, I'd want to know who I'm walling in and who I'm walling out and whom I'm likely to offend. So he's already aware, isn't he, that this wall could be offensive to somebody. As another reason, something doesn't love it. Frost, he's at the hunters. There's a mystery. It's offensive. It's unnecessary because pine cones don't eat apples or whatever way that was. Great. We'll keep going. You finished something, there's a doesn't love a wall that wants it down.
I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said for himself.
Great. Mm-hmm. Who's the wise guy here? The guy with all the insight and knows. Look at this literally for a second. I'm the guy with all the brains. I know this is stupid. They don't need it. My apples can't eat your pine cones. And, you know, it's elves, Fred, that don't want this up. What's going on?
Sarcasm.
Mischief.
Yeah.
And what are you, Fred, stupid?
Yeah.
You want this wall up? L's, Fred, L's. We'll say L's, we'll list them over here, but we know. L's, who's called L's, is that right? Mm-hmm. Sure. Again, frosty hunters, something's really mysterious. Now, well, maybe it's just L's.
But then he says, I'd really like to respect him.
Yeah.
It's not taking
he could say it to, I want him to see it for himself.
Yeah, because I see it, don't I?
Yeah, I'd like him to see it on his own.
Yeah, I don't want to tell you.
Right.
Everybody understand the depth of that? I want you to get this. I know already. Because we're coming to a great irony in this poem. Okay. So then he could say else, he'd rather see it himself, and then we've got this image of this. And here you got to read all the way into the moons of darkness. Go ahead.
I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, in the shade of trees.
Good.
He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well. He says again, good fences make good neighbors.
Does the speaker respect Fred? What image does he use for him?
Savage.
Old stone savage. And is he smart? I mean, he's seen the light. What's the other image there? He's moving in darkness. He just doesn't get it, poor Fred. And think about that.
Is this a case of an old parent tape in the guy that says good fences make good neighbors?
Of old, say again, parenting?
Yeah, well, his dad or someone in the...
Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. His father's saying, and that's a good insight. He won't go behind his father's saying. And he likes having thought of it so well. Good fences make good neighbors. Well, let's just note, what do you do with this? In each hand, like an old stone savage armed, he moves in darkness, it seems to me. Not of woods only, in the shade of trees. What? Quickly?
A darkness of ignorance.
Yeah. This guy's really stupid. Thank you. Now, let's check this.
It's not of woods in the shade of trees. It's a vicious.
I don't like this guy.
It's a vicious. Which guy don't you like?
I don't like the guy, the voice.
You don't?
No, I think he's an arrogant.
Oh, he is.
Kind of, you know, he doesn't get it. He's the stupid one.
How do you know that?
Because the title of the poem is Mending Wall.
I hadn't thought of that, but that's good. This is supposed to mend this relationship, and it sure doesn't do that. That's good. How many people like him?
No.
Well, I was kind of thinking he was right. So, I guess I'm kind of arrogant.
I'll ask two different questions.
It's stupid to keep making up a wall when there's no reason for it. They could just invite each other over for dinner and have a relationship. They don't have to keep mending a wall. You can keep your energy so much easier than that.
Yep. There's something to there's something to the wisdom of following the cycles of the seasons and having it, you know, be out there and doing this, walking along the line of the wall together and mending it together. And it's sort of this bonding thing that if this guy wasn't so in his head, you know, and so unconnected to the earth as this guy is, you know,
he just gets it all of a sudden.
Okay, we got.
Yeah. Well, one of the things is he's not getting to know the guy across the fence at all.
Yeah.
Just a little story. We just looked down a fence that was 4 years old around our property. And most of it isn't needed anymore, but our neighbor right next door, I went over to talk to him to let him know it was coming down and stuff. And he told me what he would miss was the squirrels running along it because it was horizontal. So we're going to put a little piece of fence in there for the squirrel. But it made me think about this. But it made me think about it this. I mean, if I had gone to talk to Bird, I wouldn't find out that he didn't want the fence there to keep it separate, but he liked it because the squirrels
were. Yeah. So that's a great illustration. For that fence, there is a use. And in that case, I guess it's aesthetic. You know, I like to watch the squirrels. That's good. Well, I'm going to... Go ahead.
Well, I was just wondering, does this writer have some... He blames the other person that it's behind his father's saying. But is there something in the writer's mind that his own father, you know, keeps controlling things?
The speaker's his own father. Could be.
And something there that, and he extends it to the other person.
Yes. Here's that word again, something. That's good. Now I'm going to go back to two questions that come out of your two comments. Do you like this guy, and is he arrogant? Or, pardon me, do you like this guy, and is he right? Is he right?
I don't think there's a right or a wrong. Some people like fences, and some people want an open vista.
Is he right about the reasons pine cones won't eat apples, or whichever it is?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And is he right that the frost heats it up, that something keeps pushing this thing down?
Yeah.
Hunters and frost and elves, maybe. I can't figure out what it is, but maybe that.
He keeps having to repair it, which is unnecessary because it's not needed.
We're fighting a losing battle.
Yeah, we are. But we don't even care if we lose the battle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of reminded me of Michael Dell's lecture yesterday, and he was talking about different labors in life. There's real cerebral people, theologians and stuff. And there's people like Cook, who do never-ending work. I mean, they can cook you a fantastic meal. You can sit down and be fully satisfied and think, you know, I don't care if I ever eat again in my life. And 24 hours later, you got to eat again.
Yeah.
And there's some value in that kind of repetitious work.
Yeah.
That's a little bit more specific, but maybe there is some value here.
Yeah. And that's sure a legitimate understanding of the poem, and especially of Robert Frost and all his context of all his poetry, that this existential moment matters. You know, we are doing this, and stupid or not. And I just thought of myself when I was a little kid. I was 4 years old, and my favorite thing to do was have a Skippy peanut butter glass full of water and a paintbrush, and I'd paint the concrete steps on our house. Well, I'd start with number one. By the time I got to number four, guess what? Number one was dry. But it was, I realized at four that I was having an existential moment. So that's a legitimate understanding of that. Okay, good.
But there are also routines and rituals that have totally gone beyond their original purpose and are absolutely pointless anymore. And an example was I had a mother-in-law who always used to saw off the end of a leg of lamb, and then her mother asked her, why do you do that? And she said, well, I always saw you, watch you do that when you know, you were cooking legs of lamb. And her mother said, well, that's because the pan was too short to put the whole leg of lamb in.
It had a purpose at one time.
It had a purpose at one time.
We want to get into mother-in-law's what I can get you guys.
Well, here's an irony that I want to read the whole poem straight through, but maybe you set the irony up to notice it before. Who initiates the action?
The voice.
The guy who knows it.
Yes.
So who's most trapped in this institutional routine? The guy with all the awarenesses about why not to do it.
But maybe he's only trapped until all of a sudden he gets it, that it's not necessary anymore. That's how I read it, that he's always been doing this thing, so he starts to do it, and all of a sudden, spring, whatever, all of a sudden he sees, wait a minute, we don't really need this wall.
But he doesn't change anything. He doesn't.
Well, not yet. He just figured it out. You know, it takes a little time. He's waiting to see if his neighbor's going to get it at the same time, because they've been doing this the same time all the time. Now, all of a sudden he gets it, maybe his neighbor's going to get it.
He doesn't claim any accountability, though, at the end. He says, because this guy's so dumb, we've got to get through it. He doesn't use his own smarts to say that he can do something about it.
Well, I don't think it's over.
I think it's not over, and that's the key, and that's probably where it's a different reading. He does this every spring. And the grammar of, at spring mending time, we find them there, and I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, I do this all the time. And if you want to read it in a chronological way, that's legitimate, of course. But it's also legitimate.
So you
to read
think
it,
it's every spring he gets this feeling?
Well, that's what that grammar says to me, but that's a good point, and it's fun to, there's art pointing five fingers at the truth, you know, and poetry is open to interpretation. But the point of this whole thing was to use this as an example of this process. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I'm switching my.
Anybody else wants to direct?
I'm
okay.
Sorry. Every spring.
The point is, for the purposes of this class, is to look at what forces are out there that we are so unconscious of that make us perceive the world as we do, that make us jump to conclusions about the kid with 2 days of Sunday and so on. And I have to throw in now my favorite story about, and I'm sure you've heard it, the first time I heard it was from Desmond Tutu in a sermon in Cape Town. This wonderful, it's so popular that you've heard it, but it's worth hearing again. And for me, it speaks to me about what education is and about what theology is. And the story is this guy's walking along the edge of a cliff, and it's a beautiful, beautiful day, and off this cliff that drops down 500 feet is this pristine valley, and the river's flowing through it, and there's green pastures, and it's just spectacular. And off to his left are these mountains, and they're snow-capped, and it's a beautiful day, and it's just like walking through Railroad Creek and seeing the mountains. And he's so taken with this view that he falls off the cliff. And he falls 500 feet straight down, but halfway down there's a branch sticking out. He grabs that branch, stops his fall, and there he is hanging with one arm, 200 feet down, 300 feet up, and he's in a pickle. Help, help, can anybody help me? And the clouds rumble and a big voice echoes out, yes, I can help you. Who are you? I am God. Are you sure you can help me? Yes, I'm sure I can help you. What do I, again, holding on with one hand, what do I have to do? And the voice rumbles, let go. Is there anybody else up there? And here's the theology, and it's an education. If he could let go of the most secure thing in his life, he could come to God. But he can't. And what are the secure things as we look at this poem in this guy's life that he can't let go of? You know, we don't know what there's something back there, whether it's Father's saying or whatever, but something happens why we can't let go of it. And what is it that we can't let go of your work, Rick, that we can't let go of violent responses, because that's what we have to do, and we can't even imagine another way to go about resolving conflict, you know, peaceably. What is it that we can't even imagine? I ask colleagues at where I teach, are you surprised when the black student gets the highest grade in class? And they say, oh, no. And I keep pressing them, and they, yeah, I am. What is it that we can't let go of stereotypes and prejudices and that we hold on to, that somehow they become our security? And here's John Keats, and I love this line too. Keats is talking about Shakespeare, that it doesn't matter, he could be talking about all of us. Why John Keats, the 19th century romantic poet, elevates Shakespeare in a class all by himself because for this reason. Shakespeare alone, says Keats, and now I'm quoting, could live in mystery, uncertainty, and doubt, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. But we don't want to go there. Tom mentioned that last time in Dave's discussion. We don't want to go to where there's mystery and where there's uncertainty and where there's doubt. We want to have absolutes. And if we can't find them, we will make them up, as they do in this poem. And we'll cling to those even when we know that everything else is crazy. We have
10 minutes.
10? We go to 6?
Five after.
Oh, we got so much time. Here's another poem, and this I don't have enough, so we've got to share. Here, I'm sorry, take part of these. And if you go every other person, while that's going out, I want to read this straight through. You just beautifully explicated a poem and got the sense of what it is. And it's never fair to leave art with an explication without having the experience of the art. So I'm going to read the whole thing straight through. And you can read with me. This is first the one that you already got. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I've come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day, we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. To each, the boulders that have fallen, to each. And some are loaves, and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, in the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. The power of forces, and just before we read this one by Wendell Berry, rattle off forces that come at us constantly, that unless we are keenly aware, I just heard a commencement address by William Styron in which he said, mankind, I love you. Stay vigilant. Vigilant about what? I give you a clue right here about Amy Berman's book. What's the stuff that's coming at us, shaping our always?
All the media.
The media. And so let's get specific. In the media?
Untruth.
The news.
Fox News. ABC. NBC. See, and we can keep going.
Network news, anything.
Yeah, so the point, well, the ellipsis, three dots.
News
all
that
the media was what?
News that entertains.
Okay, news. Entertainment. Okay, keep going.
Newspapers, magazines.
Okay, and so papers, and now we're listing all those in magazines. Good. Move out of the media, what else?
Self-indulgence.
Also,
we ask for it. We keep buying the papers and watching the television.
Oh, under media, okay.
We keep paying the bill, it keeps going.
Advertising.
Gertrude's grandson has a t-shirt on today. It's got about 100 little heads on it. And it said, you mean I'm really not the main character? self-indulgence in a lot of things. Okay, now get away from the media. What else?
How about parents and bosses who have their own agendas? Or just family.
Family. And how influenced are we by, okay?
Advertising.
Yeah.
There is some good news, though.
Yeah, let's hear it.
I got a great buy on insurance from Geico.
Advertising works. Well, advertising / corporations, because they're behind much of the advertising.
Corporate greed.
Religion.
Who's the biggest perpetrator of slavery in America?
The church.
Apartheid? The church. On it goes. Okay, so we got religion, and keep going.
Institutions.
Name some.
Schools. Government.
Prison system.
Prisons. And the whole system and the whole notion that, you know, we just had a big referendum, you gotta build more prisons, it doesn't even cross our mind to prevent what puts a guy in prison, just to put him in there. So institutions like prisons, like schools.
Social service.
I'll challenge the schools. As an educator, I think of this a lot. Can you name a school in your area that accepts, the college I'm thinking of now, that accepts students on the basis of their mission statement? Their mission statements are all about character and citizenship and sound mind and sound body, and what we look at is what's your ACT. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be Hitler with a 33 ACT you're in, and you have a scholarship. It's an interesting thing.
Good point.
Keep going.
Military-industrial.
The military-industrial complex. We were warned about that a long time ago.
Yeah.
Nationalism. Boy, it's so important. Patriotism, nationalism, my country, right or wrong. In our neighborhood, in our area, we had a soldier killed. He was 30 miles from a town, 30 miles outside of our town. His mother refused to put the flag on him, refused to go to the military part of the funeral. I bet there's not one person in here that heard about that. Because that didn't get in the paper, because that's anti-patriotic, and that's not anti-nationalism. It gets in the paper when they say my son died for a good cause. My wife and I had a son in the military in the Middle East, and we didn't think that if he died, it would ever have been for a very good cause. And a lot of people thought that. Okay, let's look at this. We've got a couple minutes. To a wonderful poem, and Wendell Berry is worth one of the great analysts of American society. Here's the context for this, and we'll just read a part of it, and I'll read it just to get through it. But to a Siberian woodsman, he wrote this, Wendell Berry did, after flipping through a photograph magazine of the Cold War people, during the Cold War, I mean, of people in Russia. And he, in particular, saw a picture of a Siberian woodsman just out there chopping wood. And then he imagined what this guy is. And what time did we get done?
I started at 5 after, so you ended at 5 after.
Okay, well, this isn't a 5-minute poem, I don't think. He imagines this Siberian woodsman's, it's an anti-war poem, and it's about institutions. And I'll skip through it, but you can follow, and if you want to keep it, you sure can. I'm imagining this guy now, and this Siberian woodsman. You lean at ease in your warm house at night after supper, listening to your daughter play the accordion. You smile with the pleasure of a man confident in his hands, resting after a day of long labor in the forest, the cry of a saw in your head, and the vision of coming home to rest. Your daughter's face is clear in the joy of hearing her own music. Her fingers live on the keys like people familiar with the land they were born in. You sit at the dinner table late into the night with your son, tying the bright flies that will lead you along the forest streams. Over you as your hands work is the dream of the still pools. Over you is the dream of your silence while the east brightens, birds waking close by you in the trees. I have thought of you stepping out of your doorway at dawn, your son in your tracks. And then that next verse is about he imagines his son the same way he imagined his daughter. And I am here in Kentucky, in the place I have made myself in the world. I sit on my porch above the river that flows muddy and slow along the feet of the trees. I hear the voices of the wren and the yellow-throated warbler whose songs pass near the windows and over the roof. In my house, my daughter learns the womanhood of her mother. My son is at play, pretending to be the man he believes I am. I am the outbreathing of this ground. My words are its words, as the wren's song is its song. And here, now, he questions all of these forces that have created, and well, you'll get it. Who has invented our enmity? I begin every African-American literature course I teach with this question. Who decided that for me? Whatever it is that we have decided, who decided it for me? Was it dad? Was it elves? Was it hunters? Was it a good old saying? Was it, and all this stuff, and you can list more to it. But it's surely a question worth asking, and that's what Wendell Berry asks now. Who has invented our enmity? Who has prescribed us hatred of each other? Who has armed us against each other with the death of the world? Who has appointed me such anger that I should desire the burning of your house or the destruction of your children? You all saw it. No matter where you are, this is just factual. Let's go get them. I had two guys come into my office the day we went to war and say, it's high time we didn't stand around pussyfooting. That was the quote. We've taken too much. And so the point is, who has appointed me such anger that this guy would say, it's high time we did. Let's go get them. Our school newspaper had a student editorial that said, I say nuke them. And I asked, I would love to see that kid and ask him, who has appointed me such anger that I should desire the burning of your house or the destruction of your children? Who has appointed such anger to you? Who has set loose the thought that we should oppose each other with the ruin of forests and rivers and the silence of birds? Who has said to us that the voices of my land shall be strange to you and the voices of your land strange to me? David's session just an hour ago, and other ones he's had too, about ecumenism. Okay. Who has imagined that I would destroy myself in order to destroy you, or that I could improve myself by destroying you? Who has imagined, it's underlined because it was on my lines that I couldn't erase it, or anyway. Who has imagined that your death could be negligible to me, now that I've seen these pictures of your face? Who has imagined that I would not speak familiarly with you, or laugh with you, or visit in your house and go to work with you in the forest? And then the great question about nationalism and about forces that are out there that have shaped perception. I sit in the shade of the trees of the land I was born in. As they are native, I am native, and I hold to this place as carefully as they hold to it. I do not see the national flag flying from the staff of the sycamore, or any decree of the government written on the leaves of the walnut. Nor has the elm bowed before monuments or sworn the oath of allegiance. They have not declared to whom they stand in welcome. In the thought of you, I imagine myself free of the weapons and the official hates that have borne on my back like a hump. And you can read the rest of it. It's a wonderful poem. But I wanted to have some. Anybody want to share anything?
Too bad we
don't
have more time.
I will leave you with a line from Maya Angelou in her wonderful autobiography, I Know Why the Cagebird Sings. And I'll remind you of a political situation in the last... Well, I don't remember what it was now. Laura Bush was going to host a gathering of American poets, and she canceled it. And I know why she canceled it, but I won't give you my answer. I'll give you Maya Angelou's. Maya Angelou in I Know Why the Cagebird Sings says, "We survive in the exact relationship to the dedication of our poets. Those voices that speak truth, or at least go after the forces that deny us from sorting out the truth. Five fingers, no absolutes in art, but they're continually probing. We survive in the exact relationship to the dedication of our poets." And Wendell Berry would have been one of those that got refused because they knew where he stood. We don't want him in our house. Anybody? Anything? No quiz, you all got A's. Good job.
Thank you.